Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. When Both Members of This Club by George Bellows was placed on view at the National Gallery of Art in January 1945 at the behest of gallery benefactor Chester Dale, it became the first significant work by an American modernist painter to be featured in the permanent collection. Speaking at the second annual John Wilmerding Symposium on American Art, held on March 23, 2018, at the National Gallery of Art, Charles Brock discusses how this unsettling depiction of a violent interracial boxing match was acquired when there was little American or modern painting of any kind at the gallery, and established an important precedent for later efforts to better represent the diverse achievements of American modernism. The John Wilmerding Symposium on American Art is made possible by a grant from the Walton Family Foundation.
John Wilmerding's scholarship informs almost every aspect of American art, and my topic today, George Bellows, is no exception. John helped organize the 1982 exhibition, The Boxing Pictures, at the National Gallery, and more recently, he and Alice Walton have assembled a remarkable collection of Bellows' work at the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Arkansas, including the brilliant boxing pastel, The Knockout. As the Walton Family Foundation's support for today's program acknowledges, anyone who enters the field of American art is indebted to Dr. Wilmerding. Before I begin, I'd also like to thank my colleagues in academic programs for organizing the Wilmerding Symposium, and Molly Donovan for her inspired installation, Bodies of Work, which has challenged us all to think in new ways about the gallery's collections. Both Members of This Club by George Bellows is perhaps the fullest expression of the realist creed extolled by his teacher Robert Henri and encapsulated in the motto, Art for Life's Sake. Henri admired the radically democratic spirit of the 19th century poet Walt Whitman and opposed the elitist art for art's sake aestheticism practiced by his older rival at the New York School of Art, William Merritt Chase. He exhorted his students to expand their vision beyond Chase's more socially acceptable subject matter and the privileged trappings of, for instance, A Friendly Call, another brilliant American painting in the gallery's Chester Dale collection. Henri urged his young followers in New York City to seek out new experiences in the world at large, to act, as he put it, as sketch hunters, fully immersing themselves in the manic activity of New York in an attempt to capture urban life in every dimension. Henri wanted his students to engage difficult realities that had been largely ignored, not so much to offer specific solutions to them, but to instead unsettle received notions. The goal was to disturb and to be problematic, to raise questions, not to answer them. In following the path of Art for Life's Sake, young artists aspired to break down the distance between the studio and the street, between their bodies and the bodies they depicted, between the act of painting and the act of living. Painted just after Bellows' 27th birthday, perhaps no painting embodied Henri's ambitions for the new wave of American artists more than Both Members of This Club. My talk today will begin by looking at how Both Members was, in both its subject matter and style, a singular modernist work at the time it was first exhibited in 1910. Turning to the issues of race that the painting engages, I'll then discuss how Bellows and the Henri Circle were understood in relation to American modernism and African American art by the Howard University philosopher and arts historian Alain Locke in his 1936 book, Negro Art, Past and Present. Finally, I'll consider how Chester Dale's gift of Both Members of This Club to the National Gallery of Art in 1944 was a critical early step in the gallery's efforts to address how American art was represented. Beginning with very little American painting or contemporary art of any kind in its collections, this provocative image marked the gallery's entry into what would become an ongoing conversation about American cultural identity, which continues in Washington up to the present day in ways that I believe Locke would have recognized and to a great degree encouraged. When Bellows chose to depict club fights as a way to advance Henri's modernist agenda, he could not have picked a more controversial subject. The painting reflected the shifting realities of boxing in New York City following the enactment of the Lewis Law in 1900, which prohibited public matches. In response to this prohibition, athletic clubs sprang up throughout the city, much like speakeasies later would during the 1920s. These institutions skirted the law against public fights by holding widely publicized matches featuring professional and amateur boxers from around the country under the ruse that they were somehow private matches between the members of private clubs, hence the work's title. Bellows observed these fights firsthand at the Irish-American and former heavyweight Tom Sharkey's Athletic Club, located across the street from Bellows' studio in the Lincoln Arcade Building at Broadway and 66th Street. Sharkey's was a particularly notorious club. On March 19, 1908, the New York Times reported, "The Sharkey Athletic Club ran afoul of the police again last night, and the result was one of the most spectacular raids this club has experienced. In the fourth round, while the members were figuring out how the encounter would terminate, a man jumped into the ring and blew a whistle. The inspector told all to keep their seats, then went in search of James Buckley, manager of the club, and Jimmy Kelly, who said he was the manager, a pugilist. Charged with aiding and abetting a prize fight and violating the penal code, they were bailed out by a Columbus Avenue saloon keeper." Sharkey's also hosted interracial boxing matches. For instance, on August 4, 1910, the Times reported that William Brown, a black boxer from San Francisco, knocked William Ford, a white fighter from Philadelphia, unconscious at the club. The account resonates with Bellows' painting. "When Ford dropped the last time, it was from a terrific right swing that landed on the white man's jaw, and the weakened fighter toppled over. His seconds jumped into the ring to carry Ford to his corner, and they were shocked to find that he did not respond to the usual treatment, but remained in a coma. The club physician ordered Ford taken to the dressing room. It seemed likely that death might ensue if Ford were not taken to a hospital, but the police were not informed of the accident. At 11:30, Ford was carried downstairs and into an automobile, which was driven hurriedly from in front of the club. The policeman stationed in front of the club whenever there was a stag had left by this time. As soon as Brown saw the dangerous condition of his opponent, he left and could not be located after that. The police professed to know nothing of the accident. It has not been learned where Ford was taken." Both members of this club, like these newspaper narratives, calls into question the integrity of almost every aspect of this particular slice of American life. The painting implicates those who look and look away: spectators, reporters, promoters, politicians, police, club doctors, athletes, and ultimately even Bellows, the artist himself. It registers the plight of a pair of fighters from the nation's working classes, locked in vicious combat in the boxing ring, one of the few arenas where, if they are fortunate enough to emerge with body and mind intact, they could earn money as well as make a name for themselves. At a time when the Comstock laws and other moral strictures against the depiction of the nude were still very much in force in American society, the painting displays an all-male venue where essentially naked masculine bodies are on violent display for the entertainment and pleasure of other men. When Bellows' gendered homosocial boxing paintings were first exhibited, they were sometimes, like the actual fights, deemed off-limits for female viewers and set aside in separate spaces for men's eyes only. Painted just after Jack Johnson became the first African-American heavyweight champion of the world, and when interracial matches were banned in many parts of the country, the subject is moreover racially charged. Bellows had at one point considered an offensive, starkly racist title for the painting, which he noted here in his record book, but never used. He chose to exhibit the work under the more elusive "both members of this club," a stock phrase used to announce club fighters to their audiences. While we are left to conclude, as Martin Berger has, that Bellows' quote, "racial views show every indication of having been mainstream," by not labeling the painting in such bluntly racial terms, Bellows gave viewers more leeway to react to all that the frenzied scene threw at them, to establish their own viewpoints and explore their own consciences about race and the other controversial issues the painting opens up. Confronted with a moment suspended in time, with the outcome of the fight still hanging in the balance, we are left to contemplate what exactly is happening and how the situation might unfold. What the audience, the boxers, and the artists are thinking, and what might have brought us to this violent place. The painting provokes many troubling questions, but offers no definitive answers. Everything is in play. Although Bellows was clearly a man of the left, His colleague on the journal The Masses, Art Young, once called him more anarchistic than socialistic. At this early stage of his career, he generally kept his art apart from political agendas, striving instead to convey his direct experience of events. Bellows stated, "I am not interested in the morality of boxing." His intent was instead more elemental. "I don't know anything about boxing. I am just painting two men trying to kill each other." Bellows then offered this telling observation, "But let me say that the atmosphere around the fighters is a lot more immoral than the fighters themselves." The painting bears this out as we turn from observers into participants through three stages of perception. First, we circle the scene, scanning the leering audience around us, looking at the lookers. Next, we join the crowd and direct our gaze with them up towards the focus of their attention, the fighters looming above. Finally, looking past the ropes, we move into the center of the ring and apex of the action to identify with the fighters themselves. In both members of this club, Bellows, himself a tough, accomplished athlete, more than just rendering what is in front of him, conflates the physical act of painting with the physical act of boxing. Identifying with the combatants, his brush moves across the surface of his canvas in ways analogous to the slashing, intermittent jabs, feints, bobs, and weaves of a boxer. The odd angles and puzzling arrangement of the discontinuous ropes splinters the composition. The spatial confusion signals a transition from the more traditional realism of Bellows' Goya-like depictions of the audience to the disorienting experiential realism of the conflicted areas where the fighters and the artists commune. Here, the wide-eyed looking of the spectators outside the ring gives way to the half-blind bodily sensations of the fighters in the ring. At the painting's core, the two fighters collide and merge at a confluence of black and white, flesh and blood, where, through Bellows' intervention, their inner, invisible lives of viscera and consciousness are, it seems, somehow turned inside out and made visible, transmuted into something tangible and yet illegible and powerfully abstract, pain itself. In 1915, Bellows commented on the ways in which, in depicting his subjects, he was subsumed by them. "Every artist is looking for news. He is a great reporter of life, keeping his eyes open for some hitherto untold piece of reality to put on his canvas. His picture chooses him. He doesn't choose what he shall paint any more than a writer chooses the news that shall happen or the idea that shall possess him." Employing the analogy between boxers and painters, the artist Guy Pen Dubois commented on how difficult it was for Henry students to gain any kind of traction in American society. Without the attributes of the fighter, they could expect little or no success with an uninterested American public, which, when considering an artist at all, was wont to smile derisively. The remark that Bellows made when an exhibition prize for another depiction of nude male bodies of various hues, 42 kids from the Corcoran collection, was withdrawn in 1908 is also relevant here. More than the display of nudity, Bellows declared, "It was the naked painting that they feared." Because of its vehement assertion of the vital role played in American life by both boxer and artist, both because of what it shows and how it shows it, both its black and white subjects and its aggressive style, both members of this club, for all of the notoriety it gained Bellows, could not find a buyer. It was still in Bellows' possession when he died at the age of 42 in January 1925. Following both members of this club, Bellows engaged recurrently with issues of race in a number of lithographs. The White Hope, which commemorates Jack Johnson's defeat of Jim Jeffries in Reno, Nevada in 1910, and The Savior of His Race, a scene taken from Johnson's loss to Jess Willard in Havana, Cuba in April 1915, addressed the racist obsession with finding a white boxer to oust Johnson after he had claimed the heavyweight championship in 1908. Printed in the May 1917 issue of the socialist magazine The Masses, Benediction in Georgia satirizes the hypocrisy of a preacher haranguing blacks incarcerated in the South. Finally, in 1923, Bellows produced The Law is Too Slow, to illustrate Mary Johnston's story Nemesis about a lynching and its aftermath. The print was then chosen to serve as the cover and frontispiece to the landmark 1929 study of lynching, Rope and Faggot, written by Walter White, the executive secretary of the NAACP, and subsequently featured in White's 1935 exhibition and catalog, An Art Commentary on Lynching. Following White's exhibition, Elaine Locke, who had helped proclaim the Harlem Renaissance with his 1925 anthology, The New Negro, published his art historical survey, Negro Art, Past and Present, in Washington, D.C. in 1936 as part of his bronze booklet series. In Past and Present, Locke presented a cogent analysis of where Henry and Bellows stood in relationship to African art, European modernism, and African-American art. Locke's account is worth quoting at length. The portrayal of Negro types by American artists, black and white, has become an ever-broadening and deepening phase of realism and localism in American painting and sculpture. Reaching a deliberate point in the work and influence of Robert Henry, it has spread among most of the prominent Americanists, especially since 1908, when the Henry Group organized in New York. George Bellows, Henry's pupil, continued by including Negroes frequently in his famous boxing paintings and lithographs. Bellows went in for American types and American life in the raw, with democratic disregard for social caste and artistic convention. The unconventionality that made Bellows do bar rooms and prize rings brought him occasionally to the Negro subject, and he painted us entirely out of the plantation tradition. After this, Negroes were individuals, not mere types. Thus, the double standard was thrown overboard by the realist. In addition, we learn from Bellows' graphic indictment of lynching, the law is too slow, and his benediction in Georgia, that he dared carry this theme through to social criticism and even protest. Some younger Negro artists followed, particularly Aaron Douglas. The scales of color prejudice fell from some eyes, and many Americans, black as well as white, saw more understandingly. Locke then ties the state of contemporary African-American art to the state of American art in general during the 1930s. Oddly enough, Negro art has come into its own by the very development most vital in contemporary American art, namely the desire to build an art freer from European influences and imitation, and to root American art in the materials and themes of the native scene. The startling changes of the last 10 years have proved that the Negro artist has as much or more to gain by coming home spiritually as the American artist in general. So after a long detour, Negro art has come to the fore, and progressive artists, black and white, have at last common grounds for promoting a fuller and more representative portrayal of Negro life. In 1937, the year after Locke published Past and Present, Congress officially authorized the National Gallery of Art. While the extraordinary act of cultural philanthropy of its founder, Andrew Mellon, was widely acclaimed upon the occasion of the gallery's opening in March 1941, the gallery's small holdings of American art and emphasis on other national schools also raised concerns about whether it could truly claim to be a national museum. There were less than a dozen American paintings in the permanent collection at the time, and the gallery was prohibited from formally accessioning the works of more contemporary American artists into the permanent collection until two decades after their deaths. In 1944, the gallery's early benefactor and trustee, Chester Dale, addressed these needs and restrictions in a very pointed way. Dale and Bellows had known each other in New York as young men, and Dale was a great champion and collector of Bellows' work. Realizing that after 35 years, both members of this club were still unsold, Dale purchased the painting from the artist's widow with the express purpose of bequeathing it to the National Gallery of Art so that it could be placed on view precisely on January 8, 1945, the 20th anniversary of Bellows' death. When the gallery's comprehensive reinstallation of the East Building premiered in 2016, Bellows' work was featured in the gallery's new display of 20th century American art. The sight line from both members of this club through the doorway at the right to Aaron Douglas's The Judgment Day in the second gallery demonstrates Locke's view, as stated in Past and Present, that Bellows' depictions of African Americans in his boxing pictures were forerunners to the works of Douglas and other prominent African American artists of the 1920s and 30s. The juxtaposition is instructive. Highlighting a dynamic black athlete in the midst of a violent maelstrom, with Bellow's realist proclivities for rendering, as Locke put it, American life in the raw on full display, both members of this club delves headlong into the country's conflicted views regarding class, gender, race, and the body. Inspired by the last of James Weldon Johnson's sermon poems from his 1927 publication, God's Trombones, and evoking the performative folk traditions of African-American preachers in a modernist streamlined style with allusions to Cubism's sources in African art, the Judgment Day is a more transcendent religious image. Beyond these differences, the similar stances taken by Bellow's black boxer and Douglass's lavender African angel Gabriel are striking. Both protagonists are shown with one leg planted firmly on the ground and the other raised up and bent sharply at the knee as they loom over their enraptured audiences. While rooted in the difficult worldly and spiritual dimensions that threaten their congregations, these figures also direct our attention affirmatively upwards, towards the physical confluence of the boxer's gloves in Bellow's painting and toward the radiating light and sound of Douglass's work. In addition to linking Bellows and Douglass, such correspondences illuminate how interrelated the physical realities of black athletes and the spiritual concerns of African-American preachers, poets, intellectuals, and artists were during the first half of the 20th century. And as Alain Locke's analysis makes plain, how central and integral African-American culture in all its many dimensions has been and continues to be to the history of modernism in the United States. Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.